And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. Leslie Thatcher here, along with my co-host today, Barb Bretz. Well, director Jacqueline Oliver uses three incidents in her documentary, Always in Season, to illustrate not only the history of lynch mobs in our country, how they're still used today, and how they have also come to impact our culture and humanity. Welcome to the Sundance Reel, and it's Jacqueline Oliver.
That's right. Great. Great to be here.
Yeah. The story is disturbing. It's tragic. Why don't you just start by just giving us kind of the Reader Digest version of the incidents here in the film?
Yeah, absolutely. Always in Season has been a decade in the making. I filmed in communities where relatives of the perpetrators and victims of lynching have gotten together to look at how they might be able to find justice and reconciliation. What are the things that they can do specific to their communities to repair the damage and to ideally set the groundwork for reconciliation. And I had been filming in those communities across the country, probably 8 or 9 total, when I came across the story of the 17-year-old named Lennon Lacey, who was found hanging from a swing set in 2014.
And the three storylines that are kind of being followed in the doc,
yes.
Is that the first one that drew your attention?
No, that's I had been filming for 5 years before I came up on that story. I actually thought I was finished filming. And heard about Lennon's story and reached out to his mother, Claudia, because I couldn't imagine. My son was 17 at the same time that Lennon died. He was also 17, and I couldn't imagine how a mother could handle so much trauma, and I reached out because I wanted to learn more. The more that I talked with Claudia, the more I realized that the connections between what was going on in communities where I'd already been filming and what they were dealing with in Bladenboro.
The Lennon Lacey case, as you mentioned, he was found hanging from a swing set. There are those that say it was death by suicide. Others who say there's no way that that would have been the case. I mean, do we have any forensic in the case? I mean, is it or was it just dismissed as suicide and we've moved on?
Yeah. So the police, after 3 days, came to the family to say that Lennon had committed suicide. Without having searched his room, without having looked for a suicide note, without looking at his cell phone for any kind of text messages. And so Claudia was not convinced. She knew her child, and she was open to the fact that he committed suicide. She was open to learning that if it were true. It would have been really difficult for her, but she just wanted to know the truth about what happened. And so Lennon was found with someone else's shoes on. He wore a size 11 and a half or 12. Those shoes were a 10 and a half. And there were other things, things about this case, other discrepancies that really troubled the family. The problem with knowing what the forensics were is that I've never been able to get records from the police department or the FBI. I recently got, with exception of a 7-page redacted summary, 7 to 10 pages from the FBI, that didn't go into much detail about what they had found and about their investigation. And so I'm still left with answers, and so is Claudia. And as importantly, the entire community, all the people who knew Lennon, his teachers, his friends, everyone who knew and loved him, are still left with stories, rumors, and speculation. And that was just one of the ways that this case really reminded me of what's gone on historically around lynching, because in the past, less than 1% of the lynching cases, and there were nearly 5,000 that were documented, less than 1% went to an indictment or a trial. And so it's the same, you see the same thing happening today, because we've never unpacked this history, we've never confronted it.
And I think that seems to be a real trend in some other projects here. The Traveling While Black VR installation by Roger Ross Williams, same kind of thing. And I think one of the important messages for him to get out is it has not stopped.
That's right.
You know, it's not just a historical issue. It has not stopped.
Yeah, the Traveling While Black project is hugely important, and I'm really glad that Roger is doing it. I think that there's the trend now in connecting the past to the present with a lot of films that could easily be categorized as historical, and this film has never been a historical look. Even when we look at lynching's past, I've always looked at it through the lens of how it's impacting people now and what they're doing now. And I think the trend with filmmakers is because we're starting to see this similar things crop up, racial violence crop up, the attitudes of dehumanization. Like, if you can call people who immigrate here without documents aliens, it's the same way that Black people have been dehumanized across generations. And so it's really important that we look at that. And I think filmmakers are starting to, and people in general, but filmmakers particularly in the storytelling, are connecting that history, making those connections.
In addition to just your incredible storylines that you were following, I happened to screen this on Martin Luther King Day. And there had been a meme on my Facebook that had three pictures: Martin Luther King, Barbara Walters, and Anne Frank. And it said, had all of these people lived, they're all the same age. They were born the same year. And, you know, it seems like when you see those pictures, you think of three different eras. You know, Anne Frank from long ago, Martin Luther King way back, you know, in the 60s, and then Barbara Walter modern day. But no, they were all born the same year.
Yeah, we like to think that history's on the other side of the wall. We like to wall ourselves off from the past so that it makes it more distant, and we can digest the things that have happened, the atrocities that have happened in the past. We can digest them more easily because it was other people in another time. But all of those, all of that energy of the violence and all of the lessons that were lost because of the cover-up and denial, particularly around lynching, all of those things are what can inform us and help us to understand what's going on now in our communities.
So bringing it back to Sundance, you have participated in some Sundance labs and workshops, I think, in the past. How much of that impacted the direction of this final project?
My relationship with Sundance is has been really valuable. They're like family. And I started out in the edit, the documentary edit and story lab, and really got a sense for the first time really clearly about how you use footage cinematically. And so that shows up in Always in Season. I took the aesthetics of those sequences where we start to look at the Claude Neal lynching in 1934. I took an impressionistic approach with that footage. And it was, by the way, filmed by Patrick Sheehan, who is one of our cinematographers, and was really amazing.
And was that the one being narrated by Danny Glover?
That's right. It's narrated by Danny Glover. He reads documentation from lynchings, and so the first one that I knew needed to be in there was The Invitation to Claude Neal's Lynching. And it was an invitation by the lynchers to white people, inviting them to attend. And it was published in the newspaper, it was published on the radio, and it was sent out by telegram.
And I don't know if this is something I was reading about, this group of folks in Monroe, Georgia, who reenact lynching. Is this part of your story here?
Yeah.
It is.
Tell me, what is that about?
Yeah, that's what I thought when I first heard of it. You know, it's hard to wrap your head around. But when I got to Monroe, I started to better understand. There's a diverse group of people who are amateur actors. Some of them have no acting experience when they come to the group, who decided to reenact the 1946 quadruple lynching of two couples who were killed at the Moores Ford Bridge, Dorothy and Roger Malcolm, and Mae Murray and George Dorsey. And they were ambushed on the bridge and lynched. And so the reenactors do that every year. They've been doing it since 2005. They do it around the anniversary of the time that that happened, which was July 25th, 1946, on a hot summer day. Carloads and carloads by the dozens of people caravan from one site to the next where this story actually happened. So where Roger was held in jail, they moved from there and through other sites to the gravestone of both of the couples. And ultimately, the day climaxes at the site where the lynching actually happened.
Do they have any kind of processing after it all happens?
They do. So they've done increasingly more. One of the things, some of the feedback that they get and that I certainly get is that the depiction is too graphic. It's dividing the community, particularly in Monroe. People are not very welcoming of that because they want to perpetuate the narrative that there are no racial problems in that area and that this is just making it worse. But the reenactors believe that, one is that they come out of a history of having done oral documentation about from family members and people who were living there about what happened. And so often with lynchings, there are no records of the worst atrocities. And one of the things that the reenactors portray is that the baby of Dorothy Malcolm was cut out of her stomach. And there's a lot of controversy about that. But Bobby Howard, who started those reenactments, interviewed her relatives, and they said she was indeed 7 months pregnant at the time. And so those are the things that are disputed around the reenactments. But for me, the reason why I wanted to add it to the film, that I thought it was really resonant with the story, is that they are on a very grassroots level, very organically deciding what they can do out of an expression of wanting to tell the truth about this history.
And bringing it back to modern day, one of the reenactors that you interview recalls, and she, I don't know her age, but I'm assuming she's close to my age, recalls as a young child attending basically Ku Klux Klan events with her father.
Yeah, Olivia Taylor, who I had met the second year I'd come out. I filmed the reenactments 3 years in a row, and the second year I'd come out, I did an interview with Olivia, not really knowing quite what to expect because we were moving very quickly on the ground. And she began to tell me about her how her father was the leader. He was one of the leaders of the Klan in the Stone Mountain, Georgia region. And so she ultimately revealed that she had witnessed a lynching when she was three. And that's part of why she does the reenactment. She actually came to consult on the wardrobe because she knew that the costumes that they were using was not typical of what the Klan used. They were actually much more professionally dressed. And she had a great reference for that, and then decided to portray one of Governor Talmadge's supporters in the reenactment.
And we've just got about a minute left, but wanted to mention that I understand you're working on a VR experience as well. Not of this, or is it for something else?
Yeah, so I finished a prototype of a VR experience that allows people to understand the choices and circumstances that brought spectators out to lynchings,